Hello, and welcome to the Innovation Agency podcast with me, Caroline Kenyon. This episode is part of a series finding out about some of the great work that's been taking place to support the well-being of health staff during the pandemic. This time, we're going to hear about creating a culture at speed in a crisis from one of the leaders who set up the Northwest Nightingale Hospital and a mass vaccination centre in Manchester. There are five Nightingale hospitals built to take the strain off acute hospitals during peak times in the pandemic. Providing the staffing was a major task, and recruiting the right people was just the start of the process of getting everyone to work together as a team. We're going to hear from John Herring, who is the Strategic Lead for Organisational Development and System Leadership at Greater Manchester Health and Social Care Partnership. Hello and welcome to the podcast, John.
Hi, Caroline.
John, just take us back a year to the start of the pandemic. You helped set up the Nightingale in Manchester, and more recently you've been busy setting up the vaccination centre at the Etihad Stadium. In each centre, your role was in organisational development, setting the culture, setting the tone. Tell us first about the Northwest Nightingale. At the start, we know there was a lot of pressure on, wasn't there, to get all the essentials in place, sorting out the layout and the recruitment. Can you paint a picture of what that was like for you?
It was probably, you know, for a lot of people, quite anxiety provoking and also very exciting. I think this was an opportunity for people to take action within the crisis. It felt like it gave them a purpose and a role. And, you know, whatever people think about the Nightingale, so veer away from some of the policy that might be around that. I guess in terms of the experience of setting up, I think it was really interesting because a whole team came around that, from people who were, you know, engineers and construction experts through to people in workforce, clinical leaders. So you had a whole gamut of different people coming together, great speed. And actually, you know, we learned a lot about the benefits of working across those different disciplines, really, that we don't always do, you know, necessarily in a hospital trust or a local authority or a community setting or whatever. So, yeah, it was a really exciting and purposeful time, and exhausting at the same time.
I'm sure. And a lot of people would be exhausted and probably quite stressed. They all had their own functions to perform, but you got them to break away and think about the mission and the purpose and set some values. How did you persuade people to do that?
So I think what's important about that is that, because you use the term breakaway, which, I think people perceive potentially that looking at things like that means breaking away from the work. And I think the art of it is to make it part of the work so that people are doing that whilst they're delivering the work. That's the trick of any organisational culture, is to make sure the culture runs through the way that we do things here. And I guess what I would say first of all is we didn't ask them to break away. We set the culture and we set the values. We didn't consult with anyone because of the pace at which we were working. That said, I think what I'd say and what I've learnt is that if you thought about your organisation's values, particularly in public service, and then you looked at some other values in another organisation and maybe started to take a straw poll of many of them, there wouldn't be a vast departure. You know, there aren't any public service organisations attempting to make vast profits. So, you know, values attached to that won't be in there. A lot of the Nolan principles that came out in, you know, in the 2000s, you know, will be found within those organisations. So actually, consultation with staff and leaders about what are the right values and stuff, whilst important, actually, most of us can take a really good stab at what should be in there. And it's really, sometimes it's not the words, it's the meaning that we create from the translation of the words that is the most important thing in setting a culture.
You've just undermined all those organisations which have similar sounding values.
I've not necessarily undermined them. I think I've said that if you're going to consult on those values and your purpose as an organisation, make sure it's meaningful. make sure that people are creating meaning out of it, and it translate it instead of saying, well, should it be empathy or should it be understanding that should be, or, you know, should it be, you know, if you think about the values of the Nightingale, should it be trust or should it be integrity? You know, I'd question the real depth of value that's in that. Actually, what we did is we knew what the purpose of the organisation was. And you know what? For most hospital trusts, for most police forces, local authorities, fire services, they know what their core purpose is. It's about communicating that and inspiring people with it, and making it run through everything that you do. And it doesn't need to be consulted on. There's a reason people join the NHS, and you don't need to consult on what its purpose is. You just need to articulate it in a way which really inspires people and makes people go, yeah, that's what we're about here. That's what we do. So that's what we did. Ours was easy. I suppose a lot easier than a trust maybe who's providing, you know, multiple services, saving lives. That's what our purpose was. So my challenge to other organisations was to be, yes, you may provide tertiary services and secondary services and primary services and whatever, you know, you may provide like assessment and all of that kind of stuff, but how do you translate that into a really accessible purpose that everyone takes around with them? And you know, staff would quote that back at us. That's what we're here for. We're here to save lives. It's an inspiring message, you know, and we could talk about it. And then I guess, you know, we used a mission command structure to this. So it's something that British services use. So if you imagine if you're in an emergency situation, it's really important to have a clear purpose. And everybody knows what that is. And that might be an operational purpose in the army, for instance. It might be about taking a particular point or whatever. And the reason that that's really important is because if you lose radio contact, then you need to know what your vision is, what you're there to do. And we lose radio contact in our services all the time. We can't possibly communicate. So we have to have that kind of North Star. The mission bit is the person's bit. It's to be the best, whatever you are there to do. So it's your accountability, if you like. It's your thing to be the best you can do within that grander purpose. And then the values are how we go about doing it. So, you know, again, in services, they would say, there's a really good speech by Tim Collins that Kenneth Branagh then took off. So if people look on YouTube, Kenneth Branagh played Tim Collins, who was I don't know whether he was a colonel or is a colonel, but in the British Army, in Iraq, and he does this speech. And he gives them the purpose straight out of the blocks, which is we are here to take back this country from this dictator. We are here to, you know, that's what we're here to do. It's really clear with his purpose. He talks about them as people and their mission. And if they're not up for it, then they could step away. So he moves to mission and says, you know, you're going to be the best soldier out there, you know. So he does that bit. And then he talks about the values. You know, this is, you know, his thing is this is sacred land. This is, you know, tread lightly, he says. You know, this is people's homes. If people didn't choose to be in this war, if the civilians, do not harm them, treat them with compassion, look after them, we're there to liberate them, those kind of things. So he gives them the values. That's his speech. And that is it. That's what we're trying to do. Save lives, your bit to be the best you can be in this environment. And the values we had for support, trust, act and respect.
Support, trust, act, respect.
Yeah, and you know, they were based around an emergency setup. So we chose them because people needed to act as one team. We had a whole one team vision around this. So it didn't matter if you're a security member of staff, an administrator, a caterer, a nurse, a doctor, an allied health professional, an engineer, you were all part of one team, and we wanted that approach running right through it. So everybody held up these values. And so support and respect are really key at building good teams, you know, working together for one another, and also in service. So supporting the people coming through and their families, respecting the people coming through and their families, and also respecting the site and what it was there for. And trust and act are really important in emergency setups. You have to trust your team to do a good job. And you have to provide them with the tools and the stuff around them so they're enabled to be trusted. So if they don't have the stuff around them, of course they can't deliver. And the ACT bit is people sticking their hand up and then safely feeling able to go, this isn't working, that isn't right, a mistake was made there, can we do that better? And people taking action when they see things. You could argue all of these four are really important in any setup, you know, but particularly in an emergency setup.
It makes me think of an operating theatre where we know how important it is for anybody in any role to feel confident enough to put the hand up and say, I don't think that's the right instrument or part of the anatomy or whatever it might be.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. It's that psychological safety for people to be able to do that. Yeah, absolutely. Spot on. Yeah. And really important because I guess because we've took this to the vaccination centre and I think, you know, at the Etihad, and very similarly, you know, we ran a session early on because as we were opening up pods and we had the security staff in there because they know how people come into the building and they need to be able to say there is a problem here, you know, around, say, social distancing or whatever, and they need to have parity with the clinicians who are delivering the vaccine or drawing it up or whatever. Because we're all part of one team. So trying to create that and for people to see that end-to-end process and how really important marshals, security staff are in those processes and how that enables us to vaccinate at speed and all of that kind of stuff. Again, it's the same thing. So you start to, and you know, we did that reminder with them at the start when we, that's the thing when you say stopping to consider the values. So we ran an end-to-end process with them. And we embedded the support, trust, act and respect values in there. We started off with it and we said, you know, this is how we behave around here. This is what we do. This is what we're here to do. We're here to save lives. We didn't labour the point, but, you know, we encouraged them to call it out if they weren't behaving in line with those values we've signed up to. We're asking them to act, take action, put your hand up, get involved, tell us if you've seen an issue. So it needs to run through how you operate the site and how you do things around it. It can't be something that's done on one side by the organisational development team, for want of a better term, or whoever else, who come along to set the culture and then you go back to doing whatever you're doing. It's got to be weaved through how you operate.
How do we see that in action? Have you got any example of how that works?
Yeah, so I think, so I'm going to leap to another theoretical framework. So Daniel Pink wrote a book, I think it was around 2011, about the surprising truth about what motivates us. And he picked out three things: autonomy, mastery, and purpose. So I've talked quite a lot about purpose in this podcast. So if I go to autonomy and mastery, the values are there to support those things. So if you are asking people to act and you're trusting them, they need to have some autonomy to act and to be trusted. And we know that that inspires people. It makes people feel as though, you know, I've got some autonomy here. I can do things in service of the purpose. It's always got to be in service of the purpose. And mastery is critical. So I'm going to get better at doing some of this. I'm going to improve my skills. And I think in the Nightingale, we had a few examples of it. You know, I mean, a lot of Nightingales didn't open and they were quiet. And just to be really clear, the Northwest Nightingale was operational. It saw the most patients of any Nightingale in the country. Not vast volumes of patients, granted, but it did see patients, so it was operational. And I guess within that operation, we had a number of staff, you know, junior doctors and nurses who came to us and said, because we did a debrief at the end when it closed with all the staff. So we did it with staff groups. And a lot of what people came back from with, and also through our staff survey, was I felt trusted and real autonomy. I was able to raise issues. We spotted them and we dealt with them. Sometimes a failing of our public services, they take a long time through their governance to act on the issues that come up, and that comes up through the reports, you know, very recently through maternal, you know, maternity deaths and that kind of stuff, real tragedies about, you hear the message, we told you about this before. And some of that is about the wheels and engines of governance taking time to address the issues that have come forward. It's not the only reason. So our ability to be able to respond to people raising issues is critical. And I think one of the things, I wrote a blog for the King's Fund on this. I think one piece of feedback was, how do you enable autonomy when we want some standardisation between, you know, the way we do things? And I think what's critical in this piece is being really clear with staff about where they have autonomy. So you can't have autonomy everywhere. That's a ridiculous notion, particularly when you're operating a ward and things like that. And the staff aren't asking for autonomy everywhere, but they're asking to be clear. I know where my power is, and I do have some power. I can do some stuff. Because equally, it's ridiculous to say people have no autonomy and they just have to follow standardised processes, because they're human beings and it's just not... it's not getting the best out of people. So be dead clear. And what I think that mission and those values do, and then how you behave, is you are really clear about where people can affect change, and that's where they focus. So, you know, the nurses said, you know, it was really clear it could affect change on the ward. So I did. I said, you know, we've got a problem here in this process for these patients. Or actually, we could do better around... we had a fantastic family liaison team who really were autonomous in that area. They weren't autonomous in mobilising patients. They were autonomous in linking patients up. That was where they were working. And they developed fantastic engagement with, that enabled, you know, because the average age was 85 of the people who were in Manchester Central, you know, in this big convention centre. And the modelling, you know, or not modelling, but the prediction was it'd be over 50s, you know, just people in that cohort. Well, it wasn't. It was quite old people. So we had to do loads of, we had to change our model. So people needed autonomy to change the model and then go, actually, family liaison team, right, we have to be really active here. This is an 85-year-old person. How do we link them up with their, you know, granddaughter or whatever, and use the tools that we, or ask us as a team, because we manage the well-being and stuff like that, to say, we need a few more iPads here. We need something that's going to help us to connect, because we've got isolated patients here who are old and can maybe confused, you know, that kind of stuff. So I think what we got back was that staff felt there was real autonomy, because not only were they able to raise issues, but they were able to deal with them. Really important. And I think the mastery stuff, I think some of our healthcare assistants, we enabled them to learn some new skills, catheterizing patients and stuff like that. You know, we had, and indeed we had people who joined as cleaners, who we then found out had some HR expertise, and we did have some flexibility, I know, but actually think about this in the status of a big organization. How do you find out where people have got old skills but they've needed a job? So they've come, they've become a cleaner, and maybe a lead cleaner, which this person was. And so she became part of our workforce team, because we needed another person in the workforce team. She'd got experience, and somebody who wouldn't have ordinarily been recruited.
What made the difference then? Why was it different for her in that situation?
Because there was a one-team approach. We felt really linked up to each other. I know it's hard in big organisations, but I think we do have to think about it. So my team in particular, obviously, you know, not every team is a bunch of extroverts who's doing culture and all of that kind of stuff and well-being and inductions. But the way in which they did them meant they got to know everyone on site. So there was real human relationships on there, and they found out quite quickly. And, you know, when we were looking across site, I think the story of this person is really important, and the story of, I think, of my team. So if you don't create those relationships, you don't get to know. So you think about putting yourself in a position where you're going to respond to a crisis. So you're going to suddenly deploy vaccinations across an area, and you just need people in. You need people to run it, you need people in. Or you're going to set up a COVID hospital in a conference centre. And then just, if I ask listeners to just port their mind to other areas where, because we may not be in a crisis situation, but how many times have people been asked to, we need to set this up, or we need to set that up, and, you know, the timescales are tight and stuff like that. Where do you go to get the help that you need to do that, and who do you recruit? And if you think about that, the answer to that is the people that you know. And what that does is creates a real problem for us in terms of diversity. Because when you look about those spaces where we've recruited Gold Command and all that kind of stuff, you know, and I'm speaking really openly here, you can't always see disability and LGBT and stuff like that, but you certainly can see the colour of people's skin, and there is really limited diversity. And then you reflect and you look, then you, if you stand in the middle of the vaccination centre or in the middle of a Nightingale hospital and you look across the rest of your workforce, you go, there is diversity. And where's that diversity found? It's found in your security staff, it's found in your cleaners, and it's found in your low-paid healthcare assistants. So society is at play here in this. And we have to disrupt that. And we disrupt that by spreading our circles of influence, getting to know people. One of my roles in my day job is I lead on race equality across Greater Manchester in the workforce, across public services. So my circles of trust, if you like, are different. So my team was incredibly diverse in the Nightingale. I don't really have a team at the vaccination centre. It's me and Jackie and that's it. So, you know, it's a little bit different. But at the Nightingale, I had a team, really diverse team, but the only really diverse team in the corporate side of the organisation. And this isn't an attempt to throw mud. It's an attempt to say the reason that that person who was a cleaner, who ended up in and has now got something on a CV which says, I worked in a workforce team for the Nightingale, was because we developed a relationship with her. And she saw people who looked like her in my team. So, you know, probably felt safer to share stuff. And I have some really quite big personalities in my team who would say things like, you know, we had somebody who came from the Royal Northern College of Music to volunteer with us, who was in our administration team, who was a lecturer there, you know, is a lecturer there, leads on equality and diversity. And so she was noticing this, you know, when she came in. And so you have to listen to those things, because we're missing out on a whole talent pool here. And we had a real opportunity. And what people perceive is we're in a crisis, we just need to get people in. Well, you could have done it if you'd just been a bit more mindful and spread your opportunities out. But we always go to the people we trust. So my challenge to people is open out your trust circles. Give people opportunities. Get to know them. You know, get to know different people you wouldn't ordinarily know, because there's a whole sea of talent out there. So the reason the Nightingale, and it was never full, and it was never fully staffed, so this didn't have to play out. But we would have had, and just for the women who are listening to this podcast, at the Nightingale, we had shower rooms. We would have had, if my equality lead hadn't been working with the architect planner, we'd have had a 50-50 split between male and female toilets and changing rooms and showers with no private changing areas. That's what we would have had, because it was an emergency setup. What we ended up was with a 70-30 split for females, because that's how many females we employ, with private changing areas for people who required it for perfectly legitimate reasons. And no, that sounds, it might sound like, oh, well, that's a bit of a, it didn't require much change to the planning. We didn't delay anything. We just had a voice in the room who'd thought about these things and said, you do realise that 70% of our workforce is female. And for those women out there who know, and in back in the days when COVID wasn't around and you were queuing outside toilets, you know, it's that kind of, but it is important stuff to people's well-being when they're having to work long hours and long shifts in a ward, and then they come and then there isn't enough facilities for them. It's that kind of stuff that actually becomes really important.
That brings back memories to me of outdoor events and porter cabin loos. And there's a big line of loos where there's nobody waiting, and there's another where there are lots of us waiting. It's the women's loos, and they're all in a big long queue. And the race is about to start. People don't know what to do. They head for a tree. That's fantastic. And you're right. All the women listening will be pleased to hear that.
Yeah, it's like the seatbelt stories and stuff, isn't it? The world was built for men, you know, that kind of stuff, you know. And it's like, well, actually, if you try and get different voices in the room and different thinking, then the world starts to get built for everyone, you know.
It's really interesting what you say about networks and who you go to when you need people to help you in a hurry. So you could address equality in a crisis, but you're limited if your network is limited. So the work has to be done well before that to enable equality to happen in a crisis. It's fascinating. Where did it come from, this passion for race equality? You're race equality lead for Manchester, but where did it all start?
So I grew up in on an estate in Salford, and it's a pretty, you know, it certainly was in the 80s a really rough estate. And I guess two things, really. I think one to say is that, you know, so things like the riots, we did have riots in Salford. They weren't as public or as big as, say, Brixton or Moss Side or Toxteth. But we did have riots in Salford against the police. And against that backdrop, there was a real friction between movements like Rock Against Racism and stuff like that, and movements like the National Front. And the National Front was prevalent in Salford at the time. And I guess a couple of things that I saw growing up. My best mate in the first year of secondary school was black African. And he was a really bright lad. And I never saw him after the first year, is the point. And he ended up in prison, when he was about 17, something like that. And but he was bright. So there was something about me that I was aware that what was going on, because he was the only black lad in the school. So there was some of that learning about, well, that's different. And then also seeing that, you know, there were, I remember another lad who was really bright and who, you know, lived on a really rough estate, and his family situation was quite fractured. And I suppose the second point to this is I was fortunate. So I was in the same poverty, you know. We didn't have a lot of money. We had hardly any money. But my dad was a lot older. You know, he was 63 when he had me. So he was from a different generation. And he was still working because we couldn't afford, you know, during the 80s to stick food on the table and all that kind of stuff. And then I was working with him. And but my dad had a degree. You know, he'd come from a background where he'd had a bit of money, and he had social capital. And those things made a massive difference to my outcomes and my upbringing. The lack of money also made a massive difference. So I could go to Salford Youth Orchestra with my tuba. I used to play a tuba. And, but I'd have to carry it on two or three buses, and I'd see all these people turning up in cars with their, you know, mums and dads, and I felt completely excluded from all of that. My 11 plus, I failed it on purpose, because when I looked around Manchester Grammar, I just looked at all these kids in blazers and stuff and thought, I don't belong here. So some of those things to me, those beliefs that you instill in yourself because you maybe grow up in poverty, the protective factors that you feel because you know, I was really fortunate to have my daddy. He was amazing, you know, and gave me the social capital and political capital, actually, because he was very politically active, to really think about these things. So that's why I got really passionate about it, because, yes, I have been disadvantaged, but there's loads of people who've been way more disadvantaged than I have. I had protective factors that they didn't have. It's the reason that when I walked into a house full of National Front people, I was that kid in This Is England. If people have seen This Is England, I was that little boy. All my mates were way older than me, and I did end up in one of those houses, and I knew it was wrong. And I didn't have... I had enough solidity within myself because my dad had helped build it to know that it was wrong and to know to leave, despite the bullying and whatever else that I might have experienced. There's plenty of kids who wouldn't have that protective factor, who would have been dragged along on that. So it's all of that, really, that you see, all of those things. That's why I'm so passionate about it, really.
And you've blogged about this as well, haven't you? We're going to put links to your two blogs that I want to highlight on our podcast page. Now, we've heard about autonomy and mastery and knowing your staff. But are these luxuries that you can have in a small emergency centre, but you can't have them in a big trust? Or is it possible to have them there too?
I think it is. I think remembering that the messages need to be clear and simple. I think coming out of this crisis, if we come out of this crisis, if we don't get a mutant and all that kind of stuff, what have we got looming on the horizon? And then I can... So what we've got looming on the horizon is a massive waiting list, a workforce who have been working full throttle with us. And when I say a break, it won't have felt like much of a break, but it just felt like normal between probably July and you know, September. But full throttle either side and just normal, which is still pretty hard work. We don't have a choice but to do this right, to look after them. Because otherwise, we drive people away from the professions. We're not in a buyer's market in the NHS. We need to get out of this idea that people want to come and work for us because we'll be carrying the vacancies we are. So we need to look after the people who are here and look after the people who are coming in. And we need to own that. And yes, we've got a suite of tools now. You know, we're just building a wellbeing toolkit in Greater Manchester that we're just consulting on at the moment that tries to simplify things for staff and line managers to see what good physical, practical, and psychological support looks like, both for themselves and how they do it for others. But that only goes so far because organisational culture has to support this. If what you throw at people is some counselling and some rooms where people can get some support, and yeah, maybe you give them the right PPE and stuff, but people are still drilled into the ground and don't have some of that autonomy and mastery, then it's a sticking plaster and they're going to either go off sick or leave the profession or find another job somewhere else with better organisational culture. So we have to do it. So it's harder in a bigger organisation, but I would say keep your messages simple and clear in terms of your purpose and inspiring. We do inspirational stuff here in public services. If you're working in the NHS, you are saving lives at some point or certainly improving the quality of people's lives. That's often our aim, isn't it? If you're working in the police, you are saving lives in a different way and you are enabling people to feel secure and safe. If you're working in the fire service, you're maybe enabling people to feel secure and safe and responding to those emergencies. You know, in local authorities, you are serving people and trying to hear, you know, you're democratically elected people. So therefore, you're connected and accountable to the people that you serve. These are inspiring things. You're not building widgets, so you don't have to make up something inspiring. It's there in terms of the purpose. Keep it clear and inspire people with it. You'll be hoisted by your own petard, by the way, because then you'll have to do that. You know, you can't steer away from that. People will remind you said we were going to do this. So, you know, but they are inspiring jobs and inspiring organisations, I believe. and then keep your culture really simple, your values. And use it in everything that you do. And genuinely use it. It's not just words. Genuinely. And enable people to make meaning of it. So what does it mean to trust one another in an organisation? Or what does it mean to take action? How do we shine a light and have stories about how people have done that and the differences it made for the people that we serve? Because ultimately we are in service of people. We are accountable to the people in our society. And if we can drive that into what we do, you know, it's not going to inspire everyone, I know that, but it will give us those kind of North Stars. So I think whatever organisation you're in, clearly describe why you are here and clearly describe how you do things. And the rest of your stuff, your business planning, your governance and stuff, should fall out of that.
It's great to hear that. So obviously it's not enough to deliver a set of values, a mission statement. You have to go upstream, and that's about leadership at all levels, and having the right communications, communicating the messages in the right way with the right tone. If you can go back upstream to enable what you're talking about, what do we have to do? Is it training our leaders and our managers better? How do we do that to create better leaders?
So I think, there's a loads of people who've talked about this, isn't there? I was reading a tweet from Donna Hall, who used to be the chief executive of Wigan Council. She's now the chair of Bolton Foundation Trust. And, you know, Donna was talking about leaders who genuinely listen and have empathy and compassion, you know, and how important that is. And yet, once we get into leadership positions, actually our empathy leaks. Research shows that people lose empathy when they get into leadership positions because they're there to make decisions. So I would say I'm going to try to appeal to everyone, and in the attempt of doing that, I'll appeal to no one. But no, I'm sure I will. So I've said about purpose. I want to touch on governance, because otherwise I could be labelled as being a fluffy kind of OD person who just talks about human factors. And governance is important. It is. Governance, project management, timescales, risk management, all of that is important. And it has a place. And the place it has is in service of the purpose. It's not in service of the management. It's not in service of itself. It is in service of the purpose of the organisation. And the reason I'm stating this boldly is, you know, I talked about Dan Pink's work. He talks about private industry. And he says when the purpose motive becomes divorced from the profit motive, bad things happen. And I suppose I nicked that, and I've said when the governance motive becomes divorced from the purpose motive, bad things happen. And that is true. You look at reviews that have come out, and where governance and target measurement becomes in and of itself and becomes an internal culture that's not in service of the purpose, bad things have happened in healthcare, certainly. So make sure your governance is in service of purpose, and it enables the people to do the job. It's got to do those things. It's got to enable people by managing risk well and by making sure that we're on time and target with things and all of that kind of stuff. But it's got to enable people to do the job. If it's disabling people from doing the job and it's disabling the service of purpose, then the governance isn't working. And governance shouldn't be the first thing we turn to in order to solve an issue. We often do. We have to think, let's get a meeting in place. Let's get governance around this. Who reports to what? I'm not saying those things aren't important. I need to stress that they are important, but they aren't the solution often to a lot of our issues.
And that can be the loudest voice in the room, can't it? The person leading on and responsible for the governance.
Yeah. So I think the other side of the coin is relationships. So you know, culture eats strategy for breakfast and all of that kind of, those kind of statements that people have heard. The reason is because, you know, people are hardwired and really clever to break rules. That's what we're amazing at. It's the reason that those of you who are still driving will still be breaking the speed limit and things like that. You know, there's a reality that we think, oh, we'll get away with that, or we'll do that, or, you know, we're constant rule breakers, human beings. The relationships, and I've just used the example previously, haven't we, around equality and diversity, the relationships you have and that you have formed often enable you to do the job. I remember somebody saying to me that, and this was years ago, yes, you're at a stage in your career where you won't get another job by just turning up at an interview. It'll be because you know people, somebody once said to me. And I thought, well, maybe, and my dad actually bringing me up said it wasn't what you know.
We hear that so often, don't we, in every walk of life.
Yeah. So we do things through people, through relationships. The reason that I had such a vibrant and diverse team at the Nightingale, because they were new people. I stole our equality lead from CQC, and good enough, they were very good to let Safina go. And that was, you know, just for a couple of days a week. But that's because I had a relationship with Safina, a good relationship with her. So it was like, you know, I could do that. Sam came to join us from Manchester Metropolitan University. I knew him of old. So I was able to create a team because we were able to pull on people. And you know, leaders will know that. And that is the other side to this governance coin. But it has to, all of that still has to be in service of purpose and enable people. It can't be in service of itself, in service of your, you know, career ambitions and all that. It's in service of purpose and enabling people. So those two sides of that coin about how we get things done, relationships, who we know, governance, risk management, they have to enable people and they have to serve the purpose. And if they're able to do that, then you're creating a good culture. So, yeah, in big organisations, it's going to be harder. But you can create some structures, because you're going to have to create structures which enable some of this. And you need to be able to enable people to do some of that social networking connection. They're going to do it anyway. So maybe you can do it in a culture which is positive. Maybe you can create some of that. Somebody said on a call today about well-being that actually the staff are so burnt out that they're not accessing some of this. So we, and it was meant in the right way, actually. I haven't got a problem with it, really. We're going to have to force some of this. We're going to have to really push the culture of well-being to make sure that we can look after staff, because some of them just aren't coming forward. And actually, we know we're going to have problems down the track. So we're going to have to set, maybe formalise some of this. So there's the example of governance, if you like, if you want to call it in that broad sense, of formal structures saying we're going to formalise some well-being interventions for you because we think it's important. And we're going to signal that. Yeah, so you can use your formal structures to do it. Equally, you can informally let staff do things to look after themselves in that well-being space. Just an example.
Whatever works to meet the purpose of the organisation.
Yeah, whatever works to meet the purpose of the overriding, you know, vision of the organisation and what it's there to do.
Well, on those wise words, thank you very much, John. It has been an absolute pleasure talking to you and hearing about your experiences and learning from you. I've certainly learned a lot, so thank you. Links to John's blogs are on our podcast page, the one about creating a culture in a crisis and the other about race and class in public service. So do go and read them. And thank you for listening. If you would like to hear from other experts and pioneers in staff wellbeing, some of whom, like John, were speakers at our Coaching Academy Culture Camp, check out our staff wellbeing playlist and head to our website, innovationagencynwc.nhs.uk.